fully as possible. Well, in a nutshell, and you've already seen a microcosm of markets changing within Europe alone since what's happened with shale in North America started to happen. In particular, you had players that were invested all the way to the upstream end to bring natural gas in the form of LNG to the United States that were investing very heavily throughout the value chain to do that. And as soon as shale took off in North America, those supplies basically had to find a place to go. And the first point they were actually directed to was Europe. And what that did, it created pressure on the existing pricing paradigms, the existing contractual relationships between large buyers in Europe and Russians, in particular Gazprom. What that has basically led to is a destruction of the pre-existing pricing paradigm, which was one of oil indexation. Now what you've actually seen is Gazprom relent to a lot of their major buyers in Europe and actually allow an element of spot indexation in their pricing structures. And what that tells you is that when you add liquidity to a market, you change a lot. And what that means is it begins to challenge the revenue, that Gazprom's value so much and puts them in a very precarious position because no longer do they have a captive customer. Now they actually have to think actively about price and negotiate on pricing terms, which basically changes their negotiating tactics, not only at the bargaining table for natural gas, but also around other geopolitical interests vis-a-vis Belarus, vis-a-vis Georgia. So we can think about lots of different things that this begins to impact because ultimately they don't want to lose market. So that's but one example. You can think about this spilling over into Asia as well, where the oil index paradigm has continued to persist until recently, when you actually see KOGAS actually signing up a long-term contract for a cost plus, a hub plus index for gas out of the Cheniere facility at Sabine Pass. What do you think they're going to do with that contract at every subsequent pricing negotiation they have? They're going to walk in, they're going to put it on the table and say, look, I want a gas index deal because I've got one and I've got a line of suppliers willing to provide it to me. It changes everything. It's about liquidity, and that's something that has been lost in a lot of the comments I've heard today, is there's been no discussion of what liquidity actually means for the way commodities are priced. Gas has been indexed to oil because it has not had liquidity. That's something that's changing in a dramatic way, largely because of what's happened with shale in this country.
And that concludes today's Geostrategic Edition of Earthwatch. We welcome your comments with an email to rknight, that's RKNIGHT at WBAI.org. And for Earthwatch, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning is all planned out. Well, actually, it's not planned out at all. I've got a lot of recordings, and we've got you to give us input. Stay tuned. Again, good morning. Well, I've been a little under the weather. I might have gone to the absolutely wonderful, incredible lineup at KGB Fantastic Fiction earlier tonight, where they had Chris Barzak and Catherine M. Valenti reading. And all I can say to you is I heartily recommend you get yourself a TARDIS and go to that reading. I will in fact be doing that, because Gordon Linsner, who in fact is going to be here next month, has been my standby ever since I got moved to Wednesday night, Thursday mornings, as we are at now. And this is something that happened about a month shy of 3 years ago. It's been very difficult for me to get to the KGB Fantastic Fiction series. I'm not totally out of the loop because, A, as mentioned, Gordon records it for us. I shouldn't say for me. He does it for us, for you, the listeners. And, B, I have my own reading series, which, by the way, October 1st. Don't forget the New York Review of Science Fiction readings with Terrence Taylor, Kate Locke, and hosted by Margot Adler. And if you know anything about those people, that means that you know it's going to be a reading of all vampire fiction. Okay, so anyway, what does this portend for tonight? Unpreparedness. I was almost thinking of sort of virtually calling in the show. But no, that's not fair to you, to Reggie Johnson, who was here late anyway. So I brought a bunch of recordings with me and a few options. Option number one. We chat, we take phone calls, preferably mostly about science fiction. Because in the month of October, we're going to have one or two opportunities to talk about, well, the nature and shape of the radio station. But I wouldn't rule that out. So option number one is free-form talk and, you know, maybe a quick recording or two. Two, long recordings. And this is a whole slew of them. And I have brought with me, let's see, several interviews. I have Kate Elliott, Now, I'm trying to remember if I broadcast this in July. I recorded this in July. We had a New York Review of Science Fiction reading with Kate Elliott and E.C. Ambrose. And I think I broadcast half or both of those. I also did an interview with Kate Elliott. But for the life of me, I don't recall doing that. And if you haven't heard that, you should let me know. Number three, I saw recently on some website somebody complaining from a number of years ago that I would often play Roger Zelazny reading his novella, The Doors of His Face, The Lamps of His Mouth, and said, this guy plays this every year, probably just because he's got it. No, because it was a Nebula Award and Hugo Award-winning story. Actually, it was a Nebula-winning story and a Hugo-nominated story, because I like the story, because we get to hear Zelazny talk. And with Argo, which is a movie about the making of, the non-making, I should say, of Zelazny's, in my humble opinion, greatest novel, Lord of Light, that's been in the air. So we ought to broadcast it again sooner or later. But I checked, the last time that's been broadcast was about 6 years ago. So much for the people doing that annually. And finally, as a choice for tonight, it's Sukkot. It's the Feast of Tabernacles. And here's something that I do try to broadcast every year. I'm looking for Kadok. And I know that I broadcast this within the last year, but you know what? It's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful story with a wonderful reading by the author Harlan Ellison, done for us here. And if you haven't heard it, vote for that. So which are we going to do? Tell me. 212-650-5782. I'm not going to take phone calls for any period of time. And some of these options, well, I would have to get to them immediately if I was to not fade them down in the middle, because a lot of what I've prepared was for when I was, a two-hour show. But if you have a preference, an opinion, an idea of what we should be doing this morning, give me a ring. So again, those options are, let's all just chat and talk about anything from, if you were listening last week, you heard me chatting with Lister about Orson Scott Card and Ender's Game and the upcoming movie Gravity and new science fiction, old science fiction. When I say science fiction, I mean fantasy. Ellison with I'm Looking for Kadok. Zelazny with The Doors of His Face, The Lamps of His Mouth. Or an interview and reading by Kate Elliott. 212-650-5782. I have, usually a request like this gets a lot of phone calls. So far it's not one, which makes me wonder whether or not the phones here are working. It is often that they are not. However, it just might be this system. I should mention we have stuff coming up. Next week, Nancy Hightower will be our guest, and on Monday or Tuesday, having determined, I will be recording an interview with Kim Stanley Robinson, one of the great writers in science fiction. There's a call. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello. You're on.
Oh, hi.
Hi there.
So I wanted to cast my vote for waiting for Kadok.
Okay.
Okay.
I have a preference there myself.
Okay, great.
Thanks a lot. Okay, bye-bye. Okay, what that call told me? It told me, among other things, that came in on line two, which means that line one is probably ringing. We only have two phone lines here. And it doesn't light up. We're probably getting calls at 650-5782, area code 212. And I'd never know it if the light doesn't work. Let me just check that line out of curiosity. Hello? Nope. It's a dial tone. So if you call and I don't answer, call again. But it does look like we're headed for I'm Looking for Kadok. Because frankly, I'm but one vote, but that would be my vote because it's hilarious, it's wonderful, and it fits the time slot rather well. It runs about 40 minutes, as I recall, 42 minutes and 53 seconds, which fits into this time very nicely, very well. You know, and after that, we can all schmooze together and take calls. So you know what? That's what it's going to be. This is what you call your executive decision. So it's I'm looking for Kadak. And Harlan introduces it himself. And this recording was made, it was the weekend of the Nebula Awards. They were in New York. And I would have to look up what year. I'm thinking it was about 1974. I know that this was the 70s. It was not the late 70s. WBAI was still in the church. Oh, I know how to find out exactly. Give me a moment. I know. That week was the same week that Monty Python and the Holy Grail opened, okay? Because we all, pretty much everybody who was, including Harlan, 1975, okay, I was close. So, that means that this was in April of 1975. So, cast your Wayback Machine for April 1975. It's not a live event, it's a recorded event. Although it is, by the way, an unedited event. Ellison's reading was a once-through. And no, you will not hear me in the middle say, Rick, would you read that part again, please? Embarrassed about that. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, so much the better. So, April 1975 at the WBAI studios.
This story is copyright 1973 by Harlan Ellison, and it is a Jewish science fiction story, and it it uses a great many Yiddish words.
Okay, we have to cut it right there because it's not playing back well. It's playing off of my thumb drive. Let me copy this onto the hard drive because we don't want to put up with that sound quality for the entirety. So, yeah, not the highest end, 42 minutes. It's a 432 megabyte MP3. WAV files are generally better. You care about all this stuff, right? Well, maybe you do. At any rate, we're going to copy this onto the hard drive. But if it's going to be that quality, we're going to rethink what we're doing. So let's try that again. By the way, the fact that it's copyright 1973 simply tells you when the book it came from, when came out. And by the way, let's give credit. That book comes from a wonderful anthology edited by Jack Dann, D-A-N-N, which I believe is currently in print, called Wandering Stars. There was also More Wandering Stars. And it's an entire anthology of Jewish science fiction. So let's try this again.
This story is copyright 1973 by Harlan Ellison. And it is
okay, that's
Jewish
still pretty bad. Let me fast forward, as it were. I've played this often enough. I don't know why. Yiddish
is to go join my lustmates on Bromios, but what I got to do is I got to...
Okay, it's good enough. It's good enough. We'll go back to the beginning. And put up with the slight problems. So,
the name of the story is I'm Looking for Kadak. You'll pardon me, but my name is Evsis, and I'm standing here in the middle of sand talking to a butterfly. And if I sound like I'm talking to myself, again, you'll pardon, but what can I tell you?
A grown person standing talking to a butterfly in sand. So new, what else can you expect? There are times you've got to make adjustments, you've got to let be a little, just to get along, you know what I mean? I'm not all that happy about this, if you want the specific truth. I've learned, God knows I've learned, I'm a Jew, and if there is a thing Jews have learned in over 6,000 years, it's that you got to compromise if you want to make it to 7,000. So let be. I'll talk to this butterfly, hey you butterfly, and I'll pray for the best. You don't understand. You got that look. Listen, I read once in our book that they found a tribe of Jewish Indians somewhere deep in the heart of South America that was on the earth. The earth, Stummy, it's been in all the papers. So, Jewish Indians, what a thing. And everyone wondered and yelled and made such a mishagas that they had to send historians and sociologists and anthropologists and all manner of very learned types to establish if this was a true thing or maybe somebody was just lying. And what they found was that maybe what had happened was that some galus from Spain, fleeing the Inquisition, he got on board with Cortez, and he came to the New World, kind of horror. And when no one was looking, he ran away. So then he got fablonjit, grazing the head, and he wound up in some little place full of very suggestible native types. And being something of a tumbler, he started teaching them about being Jewish. Just to keep busy, you know what I mean? Because Jews have never been missionaries. None of that converting crap, other, I shouldn't name names, religions need to keep going. Unlike Judaism, which does very cute thank you on its own. And by the time all the smart alecks found the tribe, they were keeping kosher, and having brises when the sons were born, and observing the high holy days, and not doing any fishing on the Shabbos, and it was a very nice thing altogether. So it shouldn't surprise anyone that there are Jews here on Zuchman. Zuchman, with a ch, not a k. You got a no accent like a Litvak. It shouldn't even surprise that I'm a Jew, and I'm blue, and I have 11 arms, thereby defying the law of bilateral symmetry, and I am squat and round and move very close to the ground by a series of caterpillar feet set around the rim of ball joints and sockets on either side of my tuchus, which obeys the law of bilateral symmetry, and when I've wound the feet tight, I have to jump off the ground so they can unwind, and then I move forward again, which makes my movement very peculiar, I'm told by tourists without very much class. Now, in the universal ephemeris, I am referred to as a native of Theta 996, colon, Roman numeral 6, cluster Messier 3 in Canis Venatici. The Roman numeral 6 is Zuchman. A Baedeker from some publisher in the Crab Nebula came here a few turns ago, and he wrote a travel pamphlet on Zuchman, and he kept calling me a Zuchmoid. He should grow in the ground headfirst like a turnip. I am a Jew! I don't know what a turnip is. Now I'm raving. What it'll do to you, talking to a butterfly. I have a mission, and it's making me crazy, giving me spilches. You could die from a mission like this. I'm looking for Kanak. Hey, you, butterfly. A blink, a flutter, a movement. It wouldn't hurt. You should make an indication you can hear me. I shouldn't sound like a schlemiel telling you all this. Nothing. You wouldn't give me a break. Listen, if it wasn't for that Oiswolf, that bum, Snodel, I wouldn't be here. I would be with my family and my lust nest concubines on Theta 996 Roman numeral 3, what the ephemeris calls Bromios, and what we Jews call Kazrelevka. There is historical precedent for our naming Bromios another name, Kazrelevka. You'll read Shalom Aleichem, you'll understand. A planet for schlamazels. I don't want to discuss it. That's where they're moving us. Everyone went. A few crazy ones stayed. There are always a few crazy ones, but mostly everyone went. Who would want to stay? You see, they're moving, Zuchman. God knows where. Every time you look around, they're dragging a place off and putting it somewhere else. I don't want to go into that. Terrible people. They got no hearts in them. So we were sitting in the yeshiva. The last 10 of us, our proper minion, getting ready to sit shiva for the whole planet, for the last days we would be here, when that Oiswolf, Snodel, had a seizure and he up and died. Oh, a look, a question maybe. Why were we sitting shiva in the rabbinical college when everybody else was running like a thief to get off the planet before those ganavs from the relocation center came with their skyhooks, a glitch if ever there was one, shady, disreputable, to give a yank and drag a place out of orbit and give a shove and jam in big mashugana magnets to float around where a nice cute world used to be just to keep the cluster running smooth? When they pull out a world, everything shouldn't go bump together. Why, you ask me so? I'll tell you why. Because... Mister, I won't talk or even flap my wings, butterfly. Shiva is the holiest of the holies. Eh? Because the Talmud says, When you mourn the dead, you get 10 Jewish men who come to the home of the deceased, not 8 or 7 or 4, but 10 men, and you sit, and you pray, and you hold services, and you light the Yahrzeit candles, and you recite the Kaddish, which is every intelligent life form in a cluster, except maybe a nut butterfly knows, is the prayer for the dead, in honor and praise of God and the deceased. And why do we want to sit shiva for our world that was such a good home for us for so many turns? Because, and it strikes me foolishness to expect a fakakta butterfly to grasp what I'm trying to say here, because God has been good to us here, and we've property, which now is gone, and we've got families, which now are gone, and we've got our health, which, if I continue talking to you, I'll be losing shortly, and God's name can be hallowed by word of mouth only in the presence of others, the community of worshippers, the congregation, the minion of ten. And that's why, you know, even for a butterfly, you don't look Jewish. So, now you understand a little, maybe. Zuchman was the golden Medina for us, the golden country. It was good here. We were happy here. Now we have to move to Kazralevka, a world for schlamazels. Not even a Red Sea to be parted. It isn't slavery. It's just a world that's not enough. You know what I mean? So we wanted to pay last respects. It's not so crazy. And everyone went. And only the 10 of us left to sit the 7 turns till we went away. And Zuchman was ganefed out of the sky to go God knows where. It would have been fine, except for that Snowdel, that crazy, who seized up and died on us. So where would we get a 10th man for the minion? There were only 9 Jews on the whole planet. Then Snowdel said, "There's always Kadak." "Shut up, you're dead," Reb Yeshaya said, but it didn't do any good. Snowdel kept suggesting Kadak. "Now you should understand, one of the drawbacks of my species, which maybe a butterfly wouldn't know, is that when we die and pass on, they're still talking, nudging." "Oh, you want to know how that can be? How a dead Jew can talk through the veil from the other side? What am I, a science authority? I should know how that works. I wouldn't lie on you, I don't know. Always it's been the same. One of us seizes up and dies, and the body squats there, and he doesn't decay the way the tourists do when they get shikar in a blind pig bar in downtown Chomets and stagger out in the gutter and get knocked over by a tumbril on the way to the casinos. But the voice starts up. Nudging. It probably has something to do with the soul, but I wouldn't put a bet on that. All I can say is thank God we don't worship ancestors here on Zuchman, because we'd have such a sky full of nudging old farts telling us how to run our lives, it wouldn't be worth it to keep on this side of the veil. Bless the name of Abraham. After a while, they shut up and they go off somewhere. Probably to nudge each other. They should rest in peace already and stop talking. But Snowdel, he wasn't going away. He died, and now he was demanding we not only sit shiva out of courtesy for having lived here so prosperously, but we should also, you shouldn't take it as an imposition, sit shiva for him. You're a nice wuff, that Snowdel. "There's always Kadak," he said. His voice came from a nowhere spot in the air about a foot above his body, which was dumped upside down on a table in the yeshiva. "Snowdel, if you don't mind," said Shmuel, with the one good antenna, "would you kindly shut your face and let us handle this?" Then seeing, I suppose, for the first time that Snowdel was upside down, he added, but softly, he shouldn't speak ill of the dead, "I always said he talked through his tuchus."
"I'll turn him over,"
said Chaya, with a defective unwind in his hop.
"Let be," said Shmuel. "I like this end better than the other."
"This is getting us nowhere," said Yitzhak. "The Ganef's coming a little while to take away the planet. We can't stay, we can't go, and I have lust nest concubines lubricating and lactating on Bromios this very minute."
"Kazralevke," said Avram.
"Kazralevke," Yitzhak agreed, his prop arm, the one in the back, curling an ungrammatical apology.
"A planet of 10 million Snowdels," said Yankel.
"There's always Kadak," said Snowdel.
"Who is this Kadak the Oisvov's babbling about?" asked Meyer Kahaha. The rest of us rolled our eyes at the remark. 96 tsuris-filled eyes rolled. Meyer Kahaha was always the town shlemiel. If there was a bigger Oisvov than Snowdel, he was Meyer Kahaha. Yankel stuck the tip of his pointing arm in Meyer Kahaha's 9th eye, the one with the cataract. "Quiet!" We sat and stared at each other. Finally, Moshe said,
"He's right. It's another tragedy we can mourn on Tisha B'Av, if they have enough turns on Kazralevka for Tisha B'Av to fall in the right month. But the Oisvov and the Shlemiel are right. Our only hope is Kadak." Lightning shouldn't strike me for saying it.
"Someone will have to go find him," said Avram.
"Not me," said Yankel. "A mission for a fool." Then Reb Yeshaya, who was the wisest of all the blue Jews on Zuchman, even before the great exodus, one or two of them it wouldn't have hurt if they'd stayed behind to give a little help so we shouldn't find out too late we were in this miserable state of things because Snowdel seized up and died. Reb Yeshaya nodded that it was a mission for a fool, and he said,
We'll send Evsies.
Thanks a lot for that, I said. He looked at me with the six eyes on the front, and he said,
Evsies, should we send Shmuel with one good antenna? Should we send Chaim with a defective hop? Should we send Yitzhak, who is so crippled with lust he gets cramps? Maybe we should send Yankel, who is older than even Snuddle, and would die from the journey. Then we'd have to find two Jews. Moshe? Moshe argues with everyone. Some cooperation he'd get.
What about Avram, I asked. Avram looked away.
You want I should talk about Avram's problem here in front of an open Talmud? Here in front of the dead, right here in front of God and everyone?
Reb Yeshaya looked stern. Forget it. I'm sorry I mentioned, I said.
Maybe I should go myself. The rabbi should go. Or maybe you'd prefer we sent Meir Kahaha.
You made your point, I said. I'll go. I'm far from a happy bison about this. You should know it before I go. But I'll do it. You'll never see me again. I'll die out there looking for that Kadak, but I'll go. Huh? I'll go. I started for the burrow exit of the yeshiva. I passed Yitzhak, who looked sheepish. Cramps, I muttered. It should only wither up and fall off like a dead leaf. Then I rolled, hopped, and unwound my way up the tunnel to the street and went looking for Kadak. The last time I saw Kadak was 17 turns ago. He was squatting in the synagogue during Purim, and suddenly he rolled into the aisle, tore off his yarmulke, his talis, and his tefillin all at once with his top three arms on each side, threw them into the aisle, yelled he had had it with Judaism and was converting to the Church of the Apostates. That was the last any of us saw of him. Good riddance to bad rubbish, you ask me. Kadak, to begin with, was never my favorite person, if you want the truth. He snuffled. Oh, that isn't such another. I can see you think I'm making a big something out of a big nothing. Listen, Mr. Terrific, I flap my wings and you should notice me. I'm a person who says what's on his mind. I don't make no mufki-fufki with anyone. You want someone who beats around the bushes, you should talk to that Avram. Me, I'll tell you, I couldn't stand that Kadak snuffling all the time, snuffling. You sit in the shul and right in the middle of the Shema, right in the direct absolute center of Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, comes a snuffle that sounds like a double-sounded pegalomer in a mugwallow. He had a snuffle, made you want to go take a bath. A terrible snuffle, if you listen to me for a minute. He was the kind that Kadak, he wouldn't care when he'd snuffle. When you were sleeping, eating, stooping, making a caca, he didn't care. Would come a blast, a snort, a rotten snuffle could make you want to get rid of your last three or four meals. And forget talking to him. How can you talk to a person who punctuates with a snuffle? So when he went off to convert to the apostates, sure, there was a scandal. There weren't that many Jews on Zuchman. Anything was a scandal. But to be absolutely frank with you, I'll speak my mind no matter what. We were very relieved. To be free of that stuff was already a nachas, like getting one free, a 7 for 5. So now I had to go all over there and back, looking for that terrible snuffle. It was an ugliness I could live without. You should pardon my frankness. But I went through downtown Chometz, and I went over to the Holy Cathedral of the Church of the Apostates. Is that our name? The city was in a very bad way. When everyone had gone to Kazralevka, they took everything that wasn't bolted down. They also took everything that was bolted down. They also took the bolts. Not to mention a lot of the soil that was all bolted down into. Big holes everywhere. Zuchman was not, at this point in time, I'm telling you about such a cute little world anymore. It looked like an old man with a crank, like a pisher with acne. Very unpleasant. It wasn't a trip I care to talk about. But there was a little left of that crazy fakak, the cathedral still standing. Why shouldn't they let it stand? How much does it cost to make a new one? String. The dummies, they make a holy place from string and spit and bits of dried crap off the streets and their bodies. I don't even want to think about what a sacrilege. I rolled inside, you know, the smell, you could die from the smell. And Zuchman here, listen, we got us a groundworm. This filthy little segmented thing everyone calls a pincer crusher. Lumbricus rubellus venaticus, my Uncle Beppo, the lunatic zoologist, calls it. It isn't at all peculiar why I remember a foreign name like that. Latin is what it is. I'm a Bissell scholar, too, you know? Not such a dummy as you might think. And it's no wonder Reb Yeshaya sent me on this. It could kill a lesser Jew mission to find Kadak. I mean, I remember because I once had one of them bite me in the tuchus when I went swimming. And you learn these things. Believe you me, you learn them. This rotten little worm, it's got pinching things in the front and on the sides, and it lies in wait for a juicy tuchus. And when you're just ready to relax in a swim or maybe to take a nap on a picnic, chomp, it goes right for the tuchus. And it hangs on with those triple damned, the entire species should go straight to Gehenna, pinch things, and it makes me sick to remember, but it sucks the blood right out of you, right through your tuchus. And you couldn't get one off. Medical science, as hootsie-tootsie as it is, you could varf from the size of a doctor's bill. Even the hootsie-tootsies can't get one off you. The only thing that does it is you get a musician and he bangs together a pair of cymbals and it falls off. All bloated up with your blood, leaving a bunch of little pinch marks in your tuchus. You're ashamed to let your lustmates see it. And don't ask why the doctors don't carry symbols with them for such occasions. You wouldn't believe the union problems here on Zuffman, which includes musicians and doctors both. So you better be near a band and not a hospital when a pincer crusher bites you in the tuchus. Otherwise, forget it. And when the terrible thing falls off, it goes pop, and it bursts. And all the awful crap it had, and it makes a stink you shouldn't even think about it. The eyes, all 12 of them, could roll up in your head with the smell of all that feh and blood and crap. Inside the cathedral of the Church of the Apostates, the smell, like a million popped pincer crushers. I almost went over on my face from that smell. It took 3 hands to hold all of my nose. A little whiff shouldn't slip through. I started reeling around, hitting the strings they called walls. Fortunately, I rolled around near the entrance, and I stretched my nose a couple of feet outside, and I took a very deep breath and snapped my nose back and held it and looked around. Look at them. There were still half a dozen of them who hadn't run off to Kazrilevka, all down on their stomachs, and their feet winding up and unwinding very fast up in the air, their faces down in the mud and the crap in front of the altar, doing what I suppose they call praying to that idol of theirs, Seymour or Simon or Shtumi, whatever they call it. I should know the name of a heathen idol, you bet your life never. Better I should know the Latin name of a miserable worm that stinks first, let me tell you. So there they were, and let me assure you, it pained me in several more than a couple of ways to have to go over to them, but... Listen, I'm looking for Kadak. Hey, I said to one of them. A terrific look at his tuchus I got. Such a perfect tuchus, if ever there was one, for a pincer crusher to come and chomp. Nothing. Hey, I yelled it a second time. No attention. Crazy with their faces down in the crap. Listen, hey, I yelled at the top of my voice, which isn't such a soft niceness when I'm suffocating, holding my nose with 3 hands, and I want to get out of that place already. So I gave him a zets in the tuchus. I wound up every foot on the left side, and I let it unwind right where a pincer crusher would have brunch. Then the dummy looked up, a sight you could become very ill with. A nose covered with crap from the floor, a bunch of eyes filled with blue jelly, a mouth from out of which could only come heathen hosannas to a dummy idol called Shagets or something, I don't know.
You kicked me,
he said. All by yourself, you figured that out, eh? He looked at me with 6 and blinked and started to fall over on his punim again, and I started to wind up. I'd give him such a zet that'd kick him into a better life.
We don't accept violence, he said.
Hey, listen, that's a terrific saying, I told him. Meanwhile, I don't accept an unobstructed view up your tuchus. So if you want, I should go away and stop kicking you, so you can go root around in the dreck some more. What you better do is come up here a minute and talk to me. He kept looking. I wound up tighter. You could hear my sockets creaking. I'm not such a young one anymore. He got up.
What do you want? I'm worshipping to Seymour.
Seymour. Seymour. That's our name for our god. I wouldn't even hire something called a Seymour. You'll worship later. That booby isn't going anywhere.
But Zuchman is.
Very correct. Which is the same reason I got to talk to you now. Time is a thing I got very little of, if you catch my meaning here.
Well, what is it you want, precisely?
Listen to this. Are you ready? A Talmudic scholar, no less. Precisely? Well, Mr. Precisely, I'll tell you what it is precisely I want. You know where it is I can find a no-good snuffler called Kadak? He stared at me with 6, then blinked rapidly in sequence. 2 and 4, 3 and 5, 1 and 6. Then he went back in reverse order.
You have a nauseating sense of humor. May Seymour forgive you.
Then he fell back on his face, his legs up whining and unwinding, his nose deep in the dreck. I say, Kadak? He says, Seymour. I'll give you a Seymour. I started to wind up for a kick. We'll put that mumser in the next time zone when a voice stopped me. From over the side of that stinking cathedral, and you can bet I was turning yellow from not breathing, a woman said,
come outside. I'll tell you about your friend Kadak.
I turned to look, and there was this shiksa all dolled up in such a pile of colored shmatas and baubles and bangles and crap from the floor. I thought to myself, Gavalt, this turn I should never have crawled out of the burrow. So anyhow, I followed her outside, thank God, and let my nose extend to its full length and breathe such a deep one, my cheek sacks puffed up like I had a pair of bagels stuffed in. So now this bummerka, this floozy, this painted hussy says to me,
what do you want with Kadak?
Wait a minute, I said. I'll get upwind from you. Meaning no offense, lady, but you smell like your church. I rolled around her and got a little away, and when it was possible to breathe like a bison, I said, what I want is to go join my lustmates on Bromios, but what I got to do is I got to find Kadak. We need him for a very sacred religious service. You'll excuse me for saying this, dear lady, but you being a Gentile, you wouldn't understand what it is. She batted 4 eyelids and flapped phony eyelashes on 3 of them. A nafke, a lady of easy virtue, a courtesan of the byways, a bummerka.
Would you contribute to a worthy charity to find this Kadak?
I knew it. I knew somewhere on that damned looking for Kadak it would cost me a little something out of pocket. She was looking directly at my pouch. You'll take a couple of coins, is that right?
It isn't exactly what I was thinking of, she said,
still looking at my pouch, and I suddenly realized, with what I'll tell you honestly was a chill, that she was cross-eyed in four of her front six. She was staring at my pupik. What? I'm trying to tell you, Butterfly, that she wasn't staring at my pouch, which was hanging to the left side of my stomach. She was staring with that cockeyed four at my cute little pupik. What? You'll forgive me, Mr. Silent Butterfly, with the very dumb expression. I should know that butterflies don't have pupiks. A navel. A belly button. Now you understand what it is, a pupik. What? Maybe I should get gross and explain to a butterfly that shtups flowers that we have sex through our pupiks. The female puts her long middle finger, a bottom arm on the right side, straight into the pupik, and she goes mufki-fufki, and that's how we shtup. You needed that, is that right? You needed to know how we do it. A filth you are, butterfly, a very dirty mind. But not as dirty as that Nafka, that saucy baggage, that whore of Babylon. Listen, I said, meaning no offense, lady, but I'm not that kind of a person. I'm saving myself for my lust mates, you know what I mean? I'm sure you'll understand. Besides, meaning no offense, I don't shtup with strangers. It wouldn't be such a good thing for you either, believe me. Everybody says FCs is a rotten shtup. I got very little feeling in my pipik. You wouldn't like it, not even a little. Why don't I give you a few nice coins? You could use them on Romeos. You could maybe set yourself up in business there, a pretty lady such as yourself. God shouldn't strike me down with a bolt of lightning in the tuchus for telling this filthy mind cockeye heathen Nafka what a cutesy she is.
You want to find this Kadak?
She asked, staring straight at two things at the same time. Please, lady, I said. My nose started running.
Don't cry, she said. Samul is my god. I trust in Samul.
What the hell has that got to do with anything?
We are the last of the faithful of the church. We plan to stay on Zuchman when they relocate it. Samul has decreed it. I have no hope of living through it. I understand cataclysms are commonplace when they pull a planet out of orbit.
So run, I said. What kind of dummies are you?
We are the faithful.
Listen, it gave me pause. Even Gentiles, even nutcases like these worshippers of Shmuel, whoever, even they got to believe. It was nice, in a very dumb way. So, what has all that got to do in even the slightest way with me, lady?
I'm horny.
Why not go in your cathedral there and strip one of your playmates?
They're worshipping.
To that statue that looks like a big bug picking its nose, with the dreck and the crap and the mud all over it.
Don't speak disrespectfully of Samuel.
Listen, I'll cut out my tongue.
That isn't necessary. Just stick out your navel.
Lady, you got a dirty mouth.
You want to know where Kadak is?
Listen, I won't tell you what nasty indignities came next. It makes me very ashamed to even think about it. She had a dirty fingernail. So I'll tell you only that when she was done ravaging my pupik and left me lying there against a mud wall of a building, the pink schmutz running down my stomach, I knew that Kadak had been as lousy an apostate as he had been a Jew. One afternoon, just like in the synagogue years before, he ran amok and he started biting the statue of that bug god they got. Before they could pry him off, he had bitten off the kneecap of Shmugel. So they threw him out of the church. This Nafka knew what had happened to him because he had used her services, you could brech from such a thought, and he still owed her some coins. Yeah? So she'd followed him around, trying to get him to pay, and she'd seen he'd bounce from religion to religion until they accepted him as a slave of the rock. So I got up and I went to a fountain and washed myself the best way I could and said a couple of quick prayers that I wouldn't get knocked up from that dirty finger, and I went looking for the slaves of the rock, still looking for that damned Kadak. I walked with an uneven roll, hop, unwind. You would, too, if you'd just been ravished, butterfly. Wait a minute. Just a second. You'd think on how would you feel if a flower grabbed you by the tuchus and stuck a pistol and stamen in your pipik? What? Oh, that's terrific. Butterflies don't have pipiks. Talking to you, standing here in sand, is not necessarily the most sensational thing I've ever done, you want to know. The slaves of the Rock were all gathered in a valley just outside the city limits of Chometz. The governors wouldn't let them inside the city. Who can blame them? If you think those apostates were pukers, you should only see the rocks. Such cuties. It is the Varf. Big rocks they turned themselves into, with tongues like strings, 6 or 7 feet long, all rolled up inside. And when a krendel or a znieg or a buckfly goes whizzing past, and slurp, out comes that ugly tongue like a shot, and snags it and wraps around it, comes whipping back and smashes the bug all over the rock, and then the rock gets soft and spongy like a piece of rotten fruit, and absorbs all the dreck and crap and awfulness squished there. Such terrifics, those rocks. Just the kind of thing I would expect a Kadak to be when he couldn't stand being himself no more. Thank you also very greatly, Reb Jeshaya, for this looking mission. So I found a head rock, And I stood there in that valley, all surrounded by rocks, going slurp and squish and sucking up bug food. This was not the best part of my life I'm telling you about. How do you do? I figured it was the most polite way to talk to a rock. What do I know?
How did you know I was the chief slave? The rock said.
You had the longest tongue. Slurp. A snig on the wing, cruising by, humming a tune, minding its own business, got it right in a punim, a tongue like a wet noodle, splat right in a punim, and a quick overhead twist that squish all over the rock. It splattered on me, gooey and altogether puke-making. Definitely not the kind of individual to have a terrific dinner out with. The gadarum was all over me.
Excuse the mess, said the chief slave.
He really sounded sorry. Think nothing, I said. That was a very cute little overhand twist you gave it there at the last minute. He seemed flattered.
You noticed that, did you?
How could I help? Such a class move.
You know, you're the first one who's ever noticed that. There have been lots of studies made by all kinds of foreigners from other worlds, other galaxies even, but never once did one of them notice that move. What did you say your name was?
The bug ooze was dripping down my stomach. My name is Evsis, and I'm looking for a person who used to be a person named Kadak. I was given to understand that he'd become a rock a few years ago. I have a great need to find this Kadak rock. He should drop dead already. Such a rotten time he's been making for me.
Listen, said the chief slave, as the remains of the znig oozed down through the spongy surface.
I like you. Have you ever thought of converting?
Forget it.
No, really, I'm serious. To worship the rock is such an enriching experience, it really isn't smart to dismiss it without giving it a try. What do you say?
I figured I had to be a little smartsy then, just a little. Say, listen, I wish I could. You got no idea what a nice proposition that is you're making to me, and in a quick second I'd take you up on it. But I got this one bissel tot of a problem.
Would you like to talk about it?
A psychiatrist rock yet. I really needed this. I'm afraid from bugs, I said. He didn't say anything for a moment. Then,
I see your point. Bugs are a very big part of our religion.
Yeah, listen, I can see that.
Ah, well, I'm sorry for you, but let's see if I can help you. What did you say his name was?
Kadak.
Oh, yeah, I remember now. What a creep.
That's him.
Let me see now, said the rock. If I recall correctly, we threw him out of the order for being a disruptive influence. Oh, it must have been 15 years ago. He used to make the ugliest noises I've ever heard out of a rock.
Snuffling.
I beg your pardon?
Snuffling is what he did. A terrible snort noise, all wet and cloggy, could make you sick to be near it.
Yes, that was it. So what happened to him? I'm afraid to ask. He reconstituted his atoms and became just like you again.
Not like me, please.
Well, I mean the same species.
And he went off.
Yes. He said he was going to try the fleshists.
I wish you hadn't told me that.
I'm sorry.
I sat down, settled my tuchus right down between my rims, drew up my legs and dropped my head into a half dozen of my hands. I was very glum.
Would you like to sit on me?
The rock asked. It was a nice offer, you know. Thanks, I said politely, looking at the last slimy ooze of the znig on the rock. But I'm too miserable to be comfortable.
What do you need him for? He asked.
So I explained the best I could. This was, after all, to a rock, a piece of stone, even if it could talk, about the minion of 10. The chief slave asked me why 10. So I said, on the earth, a long time ago. You know about the earth, right? Right, well, on the earth, a long time ago, God was going to give a terrific zets to a place called Sodom. What it was, this Sodom, was a whole city full of fleshists. Not a nice place.
I can't conceive of an entire city of fleshists,
the rock said.
That's rather an ugly thought.
Yeah, well, that's the way God looked at it. We were both quiet for a while, thinking about that. So, anyhow, I said, Abraham, blessed be his name, who was this very holy Jew, even if he wasn't blue, you shouldn't hold that against him.
I won't.
Huh? Yes. All right, well, Abraham pleaded with God to save Sodom.
Why did he do that? A city full of fleshists. Yuck.
How do I know? He was holy, that's all. So God must have thought that was a little meshuggah, a little crazy. Also, you know, God is no dummy. And he told Abraham he'd spare Sodom if Abraham could find 50 righteous men living there.
Just men? What about women?
There isn't scripture on that one.
Sounds like your God is a sexist.
At least you'll pardon my frankness now, but at least he isn't a thing that lies in a valley for birds to make caca on.
That's rather rude of you.
I'm terrible sorry, but it isn't nice to call the one true God a rotten name.
I was only asking.
Well, it isn't too classy for a rock to ask them kinds of questions. Now, do you want to hear this or don't you?
Yes, sure, but...
But what? Why did this god haggle with this Abraham? Why didn't he just tell him he was going to do it and then do it? I was getting pretty upset, you know what I mean? It was because Abraham was a mensch, a real terrific person, a snappy dresser, a good dancer. That's why. How do I know, okay? The rock didn't answer. I guess he was sulking. So, okay, let him sulk. Then Abraham said, okay, what if I can only find 40 righteous men? And God said, okay, let be 40. So Abraham said, what if only 30? And God said, no, let be 30 already. And then Abraham said, what if only 20? And God started yelling, all right, stop nudging me, let be 20.
Let me guess, the rock said. Abraham said 10, and your God got really mad and said 10 was it and no further, and that's how you came up with 10 men for the congregation.
You've heard it, I said. The rock was silent again. Finally, he said,
listen, I like your idea of religion. I'm not altogether happy being a slave of the rock, even if I am the chief rock. How about if I converted and came back with you and made the 10th for the minion?
Well, I thought about that for a minute. Well, I said slowly, the Talmud does say 9 free men and a slave may be reckoned together for a quorum. But against that is quoted that Rabbi Eliezer went into a synagogue, and he didn't find 10 there, so he freed his slave, and with him completed the number. But if there had only been 7 and he had freed 2 slaves, it wouldn't have been kosher. But with 1 freed slave and a rabbi, it made 10. So clearly, as all agree, 8 free men and 2 slaves would not answer the purpose. But if you just put yourself in my place for a moment, you're not, even remotely speaking, my slave. I mean, you're the slave of the rock. Whatever that means. And besides, it takes a long time to convert. Can you speak Hebrew? Yiddish, even a little?
What's Hebrew?
Forget it. How about keeping kosher?
What are they? I'll keep them if that's part of the program. After all, when you've been a rock, eating bugs all your life, keeping some kind of pet doesn't sound too difficult.
It was hopeless. It was hopeless. For a moment there, I gave it a maybe, you know what I mean? But the more I thought about it, even if I could summon up the chutzpah to go back to Reb Yeshaya with a rock, not with a kadak, it wouldn't work. This rock was a nice enough fellow, you know what I mean? But even as I sat there pondering, he shot out that ick tongue of his and snared a buck fly and whipped it in that move he thought was such a sensational thing, and he splatted it all over the place and started eating it. And clearly, very clearly, Genesis 9:4 forbade animal blood to all the seed of Noah. So how could I bring a rock back and say, here, here, I freed this slave of the rock, and he'll be the 10th man? And then right in the middle of the Adonai, out would come that crummy tongue and eat a bug off the wall. Forget it. Listen, I said, as gentle as I could. I didn't want to hurt his feelings. It's a strictly great offer you've made. And under other circumstances, I would take you up on that. You know what I'm saying? But right now, I'm really pressed for time, and it would take too long for you to learn Hebrew. So let's let it sit for a while. I'll get back to you, okay? He wasn't happy about that, I could tell. But he was a real man. She told me he understood, and he wished me good luck with the fleshists, and he let me run away fast. I could see his point, though, and I was very sorry about his not being a possible. I mean, how would you like it to sit all day baking in the sun with birds making pish in your face, and the best you got to look forward to is a juicy bug? And if I'd known what I had coming, what tsuris, I'd have gladly, only happily, as you can believe it, taken that rock back with me, bug, dreck, and all. Believe me, there are worse things than a rock that eats bugs.
And a reminder that you're tuned to WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. This program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, and you are listening to I'm Looking for Kadak, read by the author, Harlan Ellison. We now continue.
I'll make a long story short. I followed the trail of that putz, kadak, from the pit of the fleshists, where I lost the use of my pipik, all my coin, the sight of one eye in the back, the second arm on the left side, and my yarmulke, to the embarkation dock at the spaceport, where the sect called the denigrators were getting on board ships for that bromios, where I got beat up so bad I crawled away, to the lava beds where the true believers of suffering were doing their last rites before leaving, where I suffered first-degree miserable and such a pain you wouldn't accept over half my poor body, to the tabernacle of the mouth, where some big-deal prophet that was all teeth bit off the tip of one antenna, God knows why, maybe out of pique at being left behind, to the caucus race of the malforms, where I fit right in, as crapped up and bloody as I was, to the lair of the blessed profundity of the unspeakable trill, which I could not, even if I had several mouths pronounced, but they punched and kicked me anyhow, really sensational people, to the arch-druid of nothingness, always following that miserable creep kadak from religion to religion. Let me tell you, no one had a good word for that schmuck, not even the worst of those heathens, and it was there, Kenahora, that the Archdruid told me the last he'd seen of Kadak was 10 years earlier, when he had changed him into a butterfly and sent him out into the desert to hopefully drop dead in the heat. Which is why, finally, I'm standing here talking to you, dumb creep butterfly. So now I've told it all, and you see what a puke condition I'm in. Don't for a minute think that Avram or those others will respect me for what I did. They'll only nudge me about how long it took, and that's why you got to come back with me. Not a void, huh? Not a sound through all this. Not a flap or a flitter or a how are you, FCs. Nothing. Look, I'm not going to tumble with you, mister. I can't make up my mind what kind of religion I want to be, butterfly. You think I stood here all this time, sinking in up to my rims in sand, just to tell you a cute story? I know you're Kadak, ha-ha! And how do I know? Go ahead, snuffle like that again and ask me how I know! Come on, you'll either come by yourself, or I'll drag you by your wings. You know, for a butterfly, you're not even a nice-looking butterfly. You're an ugly, is what you are. And as for being a Jew, only that by birth, such a disgrace to the entire Blue Jews and Zuchman. As you can see, I'm getting angry. You've gotten me raped, crapped on, burned, maimed, crippled, blinded, insulted, run around, exposed to heathens, robbed, sunburned, covered with bug schmutz, altogether miserable and unhappy, and I'll tell you very frankly, you'll come with me, Mr. Kadak, or I'll choke you dead right here in this Fablunja desert. Now, what do you say? I thought that's what you'd say. Here he is. Yankel didn't believe it. Chaim laughed. Shmuel started to cry, his nose running green. Snodl coughed. And Reb Yeshaya hung his head.
I should have sent Avram, he said.
Avram looked away. Like a dead leaf it should fall off. Here he is what I said. And here he is what it is, I said. This is your Kadak. May he rot in his cocoon. Then I told him the whole story. At least they had the grace to be amazed.
This is what makes the minion, Moshe said. This!
Make him change back, and that's him, I said. I wash my hands of it. I went over in a corner of the shul and settled down. Was their problem now. For hours they went at him. They tried everything. They threatened him. They begged him. They implored him. They intimidated him. They cajoled him. They schmachled him. They insulted him. They slugged him. They chased his tuchus all over the shul. Sure, of course. Wouldn't you know that rotten Kadak wouldn't change back? At last, he found a thing he wanted to be, a dumb creep butterfly. With a snuffle, still with a rotten snuffle. Did you ever know how much worse a butterfly snuffles than a person? You could plots from it. And finally, when they couldn't get him to change back, and if you want to know the truth, I don't think he could change back after that weirdnik booby archdruid changed him. They held him down, and Reb Yeshaya made the rabbinical decision that his presence was enough in this great emergency. So Meir Kahaha sat on him, and we started to sit shiva, finally, for Zuchman and for Snodl. And then Reb Yeshaya got a terrible look on his face, and he said,
Oh my God.
What? What, I yelled. What now, what? Very softly, Reb Yeshaya asked me,
FCs, how long ago did the Archdruid say he changed Kadak into this thing?
10 years ago, I said, but what? And I stopped, and I sat down again, and knew we had lost, and we would still be there when the Ganavs came to rip the planet out of orbit. And we would die along with the crazies in the apostate cathedral and the Nafka and the Rock and the Archdruid and everyone else who was too nuts to get safely away the way we were supposed to.
What's the matter? Asked Meir Kahaha the Oisvork. What's wrong? Why does it matter he's been a butterfly for 10 years?
Only 10 years, said Shmuel. Not 13, Schmuck, only 10, said Yankel, sticking his pointing arm in Meir Kahaha's ninth eye. We looked at Meir Kahaha till the light dawned, even for him.
Oh, my God, he said, and rolled over on his side.
The butterfly, that miserable Kadak, fluttered up and flew around the shul. No one paid any attention to him. It had all been in vain. Scripture says, very clearly, there should be no mistake, that all 10 of the participants of our minyan have to be over 13 years old. At 13, for a Jew, a boy becomes a man.
Today I am a man.
It's an old gag. Ha ha, very funny. It's the reason for the bar mitzvah. 13, not 10. Kadak wasn't old enough. Still dead, still lying on his face. Snodl began weeping. Reb Shishai and the other seven, the last blue Jews on Zuchman, now doomed to die without ever again gumming their lust nest concubines. They all slumped into seats and waited for destruction. I felt worse than them. I hurt in more places. And then I looked up and began to smile. I smiled so wide and so loud, everyone turned to look at me.
He's gone crazy, said Chaim.
It's better that way, said Shmuel. He won't feel the pain.
Horev sees, said Yitzhak.
Dummies, I shouted, leaping up and rolling and hopping and unwinding like a tumbler. Dummies, 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 even you. Reb Shishai, you're a dummy, dummy, dummies. Ha ha, we're all dummies. Is that a way to talk to a rabbi, said Reb Shishai. Sure it is, I yowled, reeling and rocking. Sure it is, sure it is, sure it is, sure it is. Marika Haha came and sat on me. Get off me, you schlemiel! I know how to save us. It's been here all the time. We never needed that creep snuffle butterfly Kadak. So he got off me, and I looked at them with great pleasure, because I was about to demonstrate that I was a folksmensch of the first water. And I said, under our ruling in Tractate Berakot, nine Jews and the holy ark of the law containing the Torah may together, hey, Nunu, do you get what I'm saying here? May together be considered for congregational worship. And Reb Shishaya kissed me. Evsis, Evsis, how did you remember such a thing? You're not a Talmudic scholar. How did you remember such a wonderful thing? Reb Shishaya hugged and kissed and babbled in my face at me.
I didn't, I said. Kadak did.
And they all looked up as I looked up. And there was that not such an altogether worthless after all Kadak, sitting up on top of the holy ark, the Arona Kodesh, the sacred cabinet holding the sacred scrolls of the Lord. Sitting up there, a butterfly, always to remain a butterfly, sitting and beating his wings frantically, trying to let someone know what he knew, something even our rabbi had forgotten. And when he came down to perch on Reb Shishaya's shoulder, we all sat down and rested for a minute. And then Reb Shishaya said,
now we will sit Shiva. Nine men, the holy ark, and one butterfly make a minion.
And for the last time on Zuchman, which means look for me, we said the holy words, this last time for the home we had, the home we would leave. And all through the prayers, there sat Kadak flapping his dumb wings. And you want to know a thing? Even that was a machaya, which means a terrific pleasure.
Die Kinder mir haben Simches teure hat der ganze Welt. Teure ist die beste Scheure, sei von der Rebbe mit uns geknallt. Hoi, 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 freilich Kinder hat das sei, freundlich von vor allem sei, freilich von der Nähe.
Gott, ich bin ein Narren Jedel und es darf mir gut der Mai. Simches teure sing ich will und mach ne gute Käuse euch.
Hoi,
Und Tage hat sie, ich will dir sorgen als Dingsbotter, die mit Borch Hashem gesinn.
Die Weide gibt sie nach der Gläser von dem Jonti dicken Wein. Was hast du abgelost, dass die so ruft, meine Sonne ins Halle rein?
Oi, 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 freilich Kinder hat das oi, Rennle von von alten Zeg, freilich von an Eck.
Sonne. Internet.
And from the album Jews with Horns, that was the Klezmatics, and I will do everybody the favor of not trying to pronounce the name of that song. The album is Jews with Horns. And this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM, and you have been listening to Harlan Ellison reading his wonderful, wonderful story, I'm Looking for Kadok, which is, as far as I'm concerned, an Hour of the Wolf favorite. I don't know how many times over the 40-plus years that this program has been on the air that I've broadcast that, but I will never apologize for playing that again because it is a delight to listen to. I'm listening along with you, if you know it, and if you don't know it, well, one way or the other, happy Sukkot. If you would like to call up and discuss things, science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor, such as we have had, such as we generally do on this program, we'll fill out the rest of the program, which has almost half an hour to go, with calls, listener calls, at area code 212-650-5782. And it seems as if there's only one phone line working at a time, so please bear with us if we don't get to your call. Good morning, you're on the air. Nope, you see, now that's the line that doesn't, it's probably just not working, so we'll have to stick to this one. Hi there, you're on the radio.
Good morning, James, and my side hurts with laughter.
Yeah, it's a wonderful.
There are stories, and there are stories. And I mean, it's a golden chestnut. And I don't know how many times you've played it, 5, 8, who knows?
Oh, more than a dozen, really? I promise you. Over 40 years, easily. We recorded that in 1975.
Wow.
You know, so...
It stands the test of time.
Oh, it certainly does.
38 years.
Yeah.
When was the first time, was it on one of your Saturday shows that you did that, I think?
No, in those days I was on Monday through Friday.
Oh, and Harlan was in the studio.
Harlan was in a studio. That was not live on the air. We recorded that in our Edit B at the church on 62nd Street.
Do you remember if in the Wandering Stars version, where, of course, it is, the story is followed, I believe it is, by a glossary.
It is.
Oh, God. I wonder if...
And that's when you say the version, that's where it's from.
Yeah, I know.
It may have been republished later, but it's from Wandering Stars, so I wouldn't call it that version. Oh. That is the definitive. And that is what he was reading from. Probably the 6 or 7 years after Wandering Stars came out, I don't think there are too many stories that we didn't somehow honor on the air. The Bernard Malamud story, Carol Carr. I practically know the table of contents by heart.
Isn't there a story on that collection entitled On Venus Do Boys...
Have We Got a Rabbi by Robert Silverberg.
Yes, Silverberg. Oh, I see. And there's another story in there, and I don't remember its title, but to me it's the ultimate Jewish mother story having to do with a city that takes care of everybody.
That's not from that book.
Oh, it isn't?
Robert Sheckley story.
Oh, I thought
and
it
it's
was.
Actually a fixed down. It's a section of something that he wrote. It's the opposite of a fix-up. He wrote it as an episode of the novel Mind Swap. And then he turned it into the short story Street of Dreams, Feet of Clay, which I wrote an authorized script for, but have never produced because it would require, more facilities than we had, much less than what we've got.
Did you tell me also, or did you mention once, that there was, in fact, a sequel volume to Wandering Stars?
I just said it on the air a little while ago, I must have told you, yes.
Sorry, no, I missed it because I came in the middle.
I'm not sure if there were one or two sequels. There was certainly a book called More Wandering Stars, and I think there may have been a third book that got very poor distribution. More Wandering Stars didn't get good distribution either, and it took me years to get a hold of it at all.
And you mentioned one other volume of Jewish speculative fiction called People of the Book, I believe.
Yeah, there are quite a few out there, actually.
That would be nice bibliography. All right, I will let you go. I'm sure there are other people, and I will see
you. I wouldn't know. We have one phone line.
Oh, well,
okay.
Okay.
Take care.
2 weeks.
Okay. And, telephone number where, as I say, we seem to have only one phone line, as far as I can tell. It's not just that the other one doesn't light up when it rings. I think the calls, if you were to call, you'd hear it ringing, because I tried that earlier. But it doesn't come through to here. So the second calls come through, but the telephone number here at WBAI is 650-5782, area code 212. Used to be that, you didn't have to give the area code. I come from them days. You knew something was in Manhattan, it had to be 212. I think Manhattan alone now has four or five area codes. I should mention, by the way, that Ahmed Ali is here and will be doing Burn Baby Burn Clappers in just about, 22 minutes. So you do need to stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, if you're calling and you're not getting an answer, hang up and call back. 212-650-5782. I know that there are doubtless people calling, usually, especially after playing that thing. We always get a whole bunch of calls. And let's see, I can see not how many people are listening, if only we really knew that. But I can see that we have well over 110 people, actually, about 111, in fact, listening online at this very moment. Yeah, I'm thinking of actually opening this up sometime, not necessarily just to Skype, but specifically to what they call Google Hangouts, because that would allow multiple conversations. And it's all free, as long as you've got a browser or a smartphone that supports it. I don't know that they yet have group chats on Skype, which is a Microsoft product, but I know that Google Hangouts do have that, and it's something I've been thinking of playing with here on Hour of the Wolf. But who knows? I think it's going to have to wait until we make the move to 388 Atlantic Avenue. And I don't know how long that's going to be. It can't be soon enough for me, frankly, because the travel time alone will be, on public transportation coming here from where I am is well over 2 hours. And for Ahmad Ali, who I believe, he's not in the room at the moment, but I believe he's from out on the island, the very long island, I should mention, the Big G Long Island. Pardon me, as we used to say. Going to 388 Atlantic Avenue, we even have an LIRR stop there. So, I say the heck with the soundproofing. We've got pretty poor soundproofing here, as you very probably have heard during this program. The folk next door are rather boisterous, I would say. It's a good word for it. But nevertheless, 212-650-5782 to discuss things science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor. You can tell that I've got something, right? My voice peters out toward the end, and I am not known for a voice that gives up. It just keeps on droning and going, but There you have it. Did I have something else specific to discuss? This is a little bit late. But for those who have Turner Classic Movies on their cable TV sets, or however you might tune in, Friday nights, their Friday Night Spotlight this month, have been showing genius in the selection of science fiction movies that they've been doing. The first week was, alas, the best. Not alas, they're still doing interesting stuff, but the first week, there wasn't a movie that you wouldn't want to see, that you wouldn't call an absolute classic of science fiction. And they've all been future shock kind of stories. They've all been stories that are urbane, and no fantasy, not that I have anything against good fantasy. Some of my favorite movies are fantasy films, but hard urban science fiction, and starting with Metropolis and moving on. And they're doing it every Friday night. And yeah, you can skip Soylent Green so far as I'm concerned. Read the novel Make Room, Make Room by Harry Harrison instead. And in the meantime, call here, 212-650-5782, and take away my unwilling filibuster. Although, as I said, I suspect people are calling, and it's just not showing up. I can barely even test it here because we're so deep into this building. Janet Coleman called it Lewison Stadium turned upside down. I didn't realize until she told me that just last week that this location is where Lewison Stadium used to be. I came to Lewison Stadium when I was very young. Ooh, look at that. Two calls now coming in. So maybe that line is working. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there. We're on delay, so you might want to turn your radio down.
Okay. Hi, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Hi, how you doing? I've been listening to the show, and I've been listening to your show for a while, for at least a couple of years now.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got to confess, I'm not a huge science fiction fan, or I haven't been. I've been more of a fantasy fan. I've been a Tolkien fan, certainly.
Yeah, well, we cover all of that. When I say science fiction, I'm referring to all the speculative fiction genres.
Okay, no, I agree with you. I mean,
and we do an annual Tolkien show here.
No, you do. You cover a lot of there. I'm just saying, I've always left science fiction. So I like Stephen King. I like a few. I don't know if you consider some of his work science fiction, but
yeah.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
I just read maybe one of my first Robert Heinlein books. I was just in the hospital, and I couldn't find anything else to read, so I finally read a science fiction book. I read Robert Heinlein's, Podkayne from Mars? Podkayne from Mars.
Podkayne of Mars, yeah.
Right, that's it, Podkayne of Mars. It was a great book.
Yeah.
The edition that I read was a later edition where they went through an entire discussion about the early edition where the publishers made him cut it short. Well, change the ending, I should say, not cut it short.
Yeah.
And he had his original ending.
Yeah,
And then they had the readers actually take a survey of which ending they preferred.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to weigh in on this a little bit. Because, like I said, this is my first reading of science fiction probably in my life. But my reading on it is that I don't know about the talent of Mr. Heinlein.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that neither one of those camps have it right, that he developed the characters tremendously beautifully, and then I don't think the book was ready to be ended at that point. I think it was just beginning.
Hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting comment.
That's just the way I felt about that. You know, they were trying to get to Earth. She had so many things happening. He had the relationship with her suitor hanging, the brother's stuff hanging, the uncle's stuff hanging. All these things were just hanging there, and he decides to kill her off. But and the publishers, well, don't kill her like that without an explanation. Just injure her. But I don't think.
Yeah, and it's not the publisher, by the way. It was the editor, and it pays to remember that that was published in a pulp magazine.
Okay.
So what we're really talking about here is John W. Campbell, who commissioned the story to begin with, who then shaped the story that he paid for.
Okay.
And I think that Campbell was right and that Heinlein was wrong. In fact,
I agree with that as far as that goes. I just thought that either one of them ended it too soon. That was just, like I said, I thought that that story could have either easily gone on to be a trilogy itself or more. It was just the characters were tremendous.
Yeah, that is one of my preferred Heinlein books. He wrote a lot of books that I thought were just absolutely wonderful, and then he wrote a few that I thought were terrible. Totally, you know, self-indulgent beyond belief. And later on, and most of them posthumous to Heinlein and to Campbell, Campbell having died much earlier than Heinlein did, we get to see a lot of discussion about, oh, well, Stranger in a Strange Land didn't end the way that Heinlein wanted to end it, and here's the unexpurgated opinion, the version. And you know what? I think what those versions in which Virginia Heinlein and Heinlein and various people point out as the way that Heinlein wrote it rather than which I would call the unedited version, I think what it does is it proves what a good editor John W. Campbell was.
Oh, absolutely. although I thought that his letter from the uncle to the parents was a little bit preachy and self, like you said, self-indulgent.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that he was also showing, it was written in the very latter stages of his career. He was showing the
No. Podcast. I mean, yes,
I believe it was. Maybe I'm incorrect.
Well, the novel was not. Uh-huh. The novel, not, okay. The novel comes from the late 1940s or early 1950s.
So I'm wrong about that.
Yeah, but
it seemed like he was showing a certain weariness by just, you know what it actually reminded me of? If you ever read the farce in National Lampoon, I think it was How to Write Good.
that sounds familiar. I probably did read
Michael
it.
Michael O'Donnell, one of those, right? But
yeah.
He does a chapter on how to end it. Well, and then they all got run over by a bus. When I read the podcast,
and rightfully so.
I just thought of that ending. I said, yeah, okay, he couldn't end it. He got tired of just writing these characters, and all of a sudden, they all got blown up by a bomb. Okay.
Well, another thing to remember, and a reason why nobody would have touched the story had it ended the way Heinlein wanted it to, is that it was being published as one of his, quote, juveniles. Today we would call
it... Absolutely, right.
We would call it young adult fiction.
Right. It's for kids. They got to just see it. Well, now she's dead. So,
okay. The novel was written for people of Podkayne's age. It was written for teenagers.
Yeah, teenagers, 15, 16-year-old kids. No, you're right.
And in the 1940s, in the 1950s, you didn't end up a story for teenagers by blowing everybody to kingdom. Them come.
Like I said, I believe the author shortchanged himself. That book, it just had so much potential for development. He could have had her in Earth. He could have had her.
I'll tell you one thing. It would make a great movie.
Absolutely. It absolutely would. It's something that should be picked up by someone. You're absolutely right. It would be fantastic.
Yeah. All the Heinlein juveniles would, and some of them were insofar as the stories were, shall we say, borrowed for other movies. They made a couple of movies based on Heinlein, including The Puppet Master, starring Donald Sutherland, and that's a very uneven film. It starts out... The funny thing is, as long as it's actually faithful to what Heinlein wrote, it works. But when it... takes off onto its own concepts and ideas, the whole thing just falls apart. And alas, it does fall apart at the very end. But it's not a bad film. I'm trying to think. Well, Heinlein wrote a couple of movies himself, most of which sucked, under his pseudonym Anson MacDonald.
Okay.
And I
gotta check some of this stuff out. Like I said, I'm kind of new to the genre in a sense, but
you're actually not, because there is no difference between science fiction and fantasy. They're really just both. The question is science fiction a subgenre of fantasy, which an argument can be made that it's all fantastic literature, and therefore science fiction is fantastic literature that limits some of the things, or is fantasy a, you know, another word for another way of looking at science fiction? And I will tell you that Mr. Heinlein in 1946 coined another word, speculative fiction. And a lot of people think that spec fic or speculative fiction is in fact very modern, touchy-feely kind of way of viewing the entire thing, but it's not. It actually goes back to Heinlein, and it simply, you know, the name says it all. Science fiction is a terrible name for the genre. Certainly everything Stephen King writes, with the exception of like The Body and a few of his shorter works, are either science fiction or fantasy.
And I love Stephen King.
He's a great writer. I'm not a fan of horror myself personally.
Okay.
But I appreciate good prose. I appreciate good structure of writing. And he does these things.
He does a lot in his writing that you don't see in the movies. Find kind of amazing, some of the stuff. But
yeah, the movie versions of King's work tend to suck.
Yeah,
and
they simplify things. It's there are a few things in there that I find very, very interesting in King's work. But
and the same is true of Philip K. Dick, who is probably at this point the most filmed science fiction fantasy, or let's say speculative fiction writer, and mm-hmm. most of the films really stink.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I agree with that.
But a few of them are brilliant. My favorite one probably being A Scanner Darkly, which is relatively unknown, directed by Richard Linklater, and is rotoscoped. It uses live-action figures that are then animated.
Okay.
It stars Woody Harrelson.
Sounds like regarding the literature, you almost sound like what Duke Ellington said about music, that there's really only two types of music, good and bad.
Yeah.
Trying to pigeonhole these things is always difficult. That's, well,
absolutely, and should not be done. I mean, is Ellington classical or jazz? And the answer is
question. Yeah,
the answer is yes.
Yes, exactly. That's the answer is he's good.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, absolutely.
The answer is good. That's, yeah, and it's the same thing, but no, after listening to your show, I've gotten more sensitive to the distinctions between the two, you know, the various specific genres.
Yeah, but you know, there are writers out there, especially today, there are writers out there who are purposefully muddying those waters. You know, it's not science fiction, it's not fantasy, but it is science. They have so many words for this stuff.
What you play tonight, is that Jewish literature or is it science fiction? It's a little of both.
Yes.
Beautiful. That show was tremendous just now.
Or was it fantasy?
I liked it. I loved that show. It was funnier than hell.
The bottom line is, was it science fiction? Was it fantasy? And my question is, did you like it?
I loved it. I loved well, it. I loved what you just played. That was
a great
choice.
I once had a writer on the air, and he read this story, and it was a wonderful story. I was totally enraptured, enchanted with what he was writing. Or I shouldn't say enchanted because it was a dark story. And when it was done, a listener called up and said, how is that either science fiction or fantasy? And we thought about it and said, it isn't. Did you like it? Oh, yeah, it was a great story. Then we've done our job here.
We've entertained you.
Yeah. Now, there is something to be said for certain science fiction when it's trying to teach, political kinds of things, the way 1984 or Brave New World.
Although I've read those. Those are great
books. Oh, those are science fiction books, wouldn't you say?
Okay. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. You know, what's not science fiction about them?
Yeah, the future. Yeah, it looks at the future.
Yeah, and I've been busy rereading Michael Swanwick, who writes very political, high-end fiction, which is set in a world of fairy, and yet is nevertheless really brilliant political writing and possibly, at times, great literature. So there comes the question. And if you're into fantasy, I definitely recommend Michael Swanwick, including the Iron Dragon's Daughter and another book set in that same universe, The Dragons of Babel. But do not think that this resembles in any way, shape, or form any fantasy that you've ever read in your life. It may have haints and fays and fairies and humans and magic, but it's hardcore political fiction.
That sounds good. It sounds like good reading.
It is. And I totally recommend his stuff. Listen, I'm out of time.
Oh, I appreciate you giving me time and taking it off topic especially.
No, you didn't take it off topic. You were dead on topic.
Okay, well, I mean, I wanted to do the Heinlein thing, which, like I said, it was a question bugging me since I read the book. I had my own take on it. I said, well, nobody mentioned that they thought it needed further development. But I just wanted to get that point across.
Well, the thing that I would say about that I think is very important is edit. And this says something, by the way, about self-publishing. Editors are very, very, very important. And if people decide to self-publish, that's one thing. But if you pass it by without an editor, you are going into the dark side.
Right. Absolutely.
In a bad way.
Especially with the computer's ability to just get you there very quickly without even adequate proofing.
Yeah, and well, exactly. Okay, thanks so much for calling.
Thank you very much. Keep it up.
Okay, thanks a lot. Good night. And speaking of fantasy, my guest next week will be Nancy Hightower, who has a new fantasy novel out and is an expert on things fantastic. Speaking of things fantastic, Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Ahmed Ali. And coming your way in 2.5 minutes over these airwaves. And thank you for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Look up the Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook. Send me an email, etc., etc. Happy, what is it, Feast of the Tabernacle. It's Sukkot, folks. Enjoy. Have some fruit. Good morning.
Set my sails of silver.
And you are listening to WBAI in New York, and the show coming up is Burn Baby Burn. And I want to thank Jim Freund for another wonderful Hour of the Wolf. But this is, what hour is this now? The Hour of Burn Baby Burn.
Actually, we're coming up on Hour of the Wolf now.
Okay. There it is. Almost back to where you started.
I think we finished the fox.
Hour of the Fox.
Yes.
Shut the fox up.
I would love to. They do terrible news.
Jim, great to see you again.
Good morning.
Good morning. Wake up. Wake up, everybody.
change again, just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, wake the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the tales. They don't have so very long before their judgment day. So won't you make them happy before they pass away?
Up. Just for the breath of life, I thank my maker. My mind say I come from hustlers and shakers. My mind building on skyscrapers and acres. He said, take us back to where we belong. I try to write a song as sweet as the Psalms. Though I'm the type to bear arms and wear my heart on my sleeve. Even when I fell in God, I believe. Read the days and weave through the maze. And the seas are so amazing. Feed them and raise them. Seasons are aging. Earthquakes, wars and rumors. I want us to get by, but we more than consumers. We more than shooters. More than looters, created in this image so God lived through us. And even in this generation, living through computers, only love can reboot us.
Oh, wake up everybody, no more sleeping in bed.
Oh, wake up everybody, yeah.
Cause I need a little help, I can't do it alone.
Hi, this is Roy Ayers. If Cafe LE is not on your radio, then your radio is not on.
Whoa, 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 let me lift you up to the sky, so high.
wanna get you hot while you were up. Whoa, 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 whoa.
Well, Albert Collins is going to tell us about the full moon in a moment. Remember Albert Collins? From his Alligator Records release, The Moon Is Full. And isn't it? Do an Earth Watch and look up in the sky and see that full moon.
Catch that train in the morning, y'all.